You're listening to the John C. Scott Political Forum. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Thank you and good afternoon. Welcome to part two of our show. Governor Doug Ducey and GOP leaders in the Arizona legislature have agreed to a budget framework that funds most of the governor's priorities while making concessions to some lawmakers who have specific demands for what they want to see in the state's spending plan. Now, those may not go far enough. The plan appears short of the votes needed to pass. Four Republican senators say they would oppose the plan after they were briefed on it. Republicans hold, by the way, a slim majority in both chambers. The Democrats say they've been ignored so far in the negotiating process. Documents detailing an agreement between the GOP leaders and the Arizona legislature and the governor's office show many of the Ducey priorities still intact, but only slightly adjusted. The $11.8 billion deal, which would take effect when the new fiscal year starts July 1st, is an increase of more than $1 billion over last year's spending plan. The Public Safety Free Institute last year, which several Republican lawmakers derided, would be phased out over the next few years. The Arizona Republic shows that Ducey unveiled his budget proposal in January, wanted the state's revenues to run into trouble with Republican lawmakers who didn't want to increase the rainy day fund by such a large amount. Republican lawmakers also didn't want to see eye to eye with the governor on how the state should alter its tax code to allow for changes in the federal tax laws. The budget, by the way, long jam, may be clearing if the agreement wins the lawmakers' approval. The spending will fall mostly in Ducey's favor. And under the agreement between the Republican leaders and the governor, the state would increase its rainy day fund to $1 billion with infusions of $271 million in the current fiscal year and in the fiscal year beginning July 1st. $130 million plan to expand Interstate 17 over the next 3 years at areas where motorists often hit heavy traffic is also included in the deal. And the next step of the 20 by 20 teacher pay raise, the 5% raise goes into effect, and $136 million in additional assistance for schools would be included. Senate GOP budget documents obtained by the Republic leaked earlier this month showed that Ducey and his fellow Republicans more than far apart on the budget negotiations. The agreement reached this week shows a major compromise on most points. On Sunday, the Senate President Karen Fann called it a good bipartisan budget. Democrats in both chambers said they were mostly left out of the negotiations since Republicans control both chambers of the legislature and, of course, the governor's office. The Senate Minority Leader David Bradley of Tucson said at the afternoon press conference that it appears Republican leaders had incorporated some Democratic ideas into the budget, perhaps on the premise that fulfilling the state's series of small requests of the minority will achieve, well, silence and consent. But placating is not negotiating, he said, adding Democrats had been consistently knocking on the closed budget doors. We're waiting for Andrea D'Alessandro, having trouble even though we had scheduled her for this 4 o'clock time. Let's take a quick break and then we'll try to fill for Andrea D'Alessandro. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the John C. Scott Show. Coming up, Andrea D'Alessandro, State Senator. The budget wrangling is what we'll call it. Then I'm going to bring on Ed Ackerley, independent candidate for mayor. You should take him seriously. He takes himself seriously. And I'm looking forward to that interview as well. Then Don Jorgensen, former chair of the Democratic Party, will be with us. Here's State Senator Andrea D'Alessandro. Senator, thank you so much. Where are you in this budget process? You're not going to vote on this thing tonight, are you? I mean, what's going on?
No. I'll tell you, I'm sitting in the members' lounge of the Senate, and we just adjourned until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. And I just want to share with you my concerns about tax decreases for individuals. I have just made three tweets about with a poll asking people, would you rather get a deduction for non-itemizers of 25% of your charitable deductions, or would you rather invest in public education? Would you like the rates to be slightly lowered, or would you rather invest in public education? And the third area is, do you want a bigger standard deduction, you know, for people who don't itemize, or would you rather invest in public education? John, I don't know what the poll will say, but I expect that people who are making charitable deductions would rather support public education. You know, there's been a lot of polling this year by several independent groups, and the general consensus with over 60% of the respondents is that invest more in education. And I think this budget is just going the wrong way. Individuals are not already. We have a low rate in Arizona, and there are so many credits available to people that it's just ridiculous to lower it even more. And while we have serious needs in our classrooms with both teacher pay and physical structures, you know, I've also often talked that, you know, if we had this money that we should have spent long ago on public education, we should invest now for deferred maintenance, whether it's a leaky roof or 8-year-old computers or other things. And I'm just really appalled by this Republican budget to have further tax increases. And John, you know, it's like a Roach Motel. Any tax decrease that we do, any decrease in rate or increase in standard deduction is permanent. And that's what got us in the mess with the horrible defunding of public education. You know, we're a growing state. We're going to have more families. We're going to have more children. They should think to the future instead of going back to the past. You know, it's just the wrong way to go.
By the way, I understand why you're going to work all holiday weekend. I mean, Friday, Saturday, Sunday or something. And how are you going to pull these four dissidents on board here? They all want separate things.
I can't speak about anyone else, but what they're telling us is to expect to be here. We'll be here Friday at 10 o'clock, as I mentioned, and to plan on being here Saturday. They will not be working us on Sunday, but they expect us back on Monday.
Monday's a holiday.
Yes. Yeah, I know. But I'm telling the teachers out there, they'll be here on Monday if we're still at this on Monday.
Oh, my goodness.
And you know, John, the whole reason that I've taken this job, which costs me more to serve than I make, is to support public education. And this is just unconscionable. And I'm not hearing anyone say, lower the individual income tax rates. Give me a bigger standard deduction. You know, because the Arizona rates, individual rates, are low already. And people who, you know, some people do charitable deductions for that become credits, and so they actually make money on the deal. This is just the wrong way to go. But the Republicans, you know, just want to say, oh, we lowered the taxes. Well, when you lower the taxes, when they're already low, you just get a systemic defunding of public education. And I don't believe that's what the voters want. You know, so just, you know, my tweets, the Twitter account lets you do polls. And I have the three separate. Do you want to support public education, or do you want a deduction for non-itemizers? So if you give $100 to a charity and you don't qualify to itemize, then you can get $25 deduction. I mean, or would you rather support public?
By the way, these dissidents, these four Republican senators, how are they going to satisfy them and get to enough numbers to pass a budget out of the upper chamber? How are they going to do that?
Well, you know, there are a lot of private meetings that I'm not invited to, but you know that Senator Boyer's issue about extending the statute of limitations for children who were abused as children. People who are vulnerable and who have been, sexually abused. Often we had people at the press conference on Monday. Sometimes they don't have it together enough to be able to confront their, you know, the person who abused them, how to bring it forward to the family. To, you know, it's just very, very complicated. And sometimes when they realize someone else is being abused, they gather the strength to do it. It's a very complicated process. And I was very moved by someone who was at Senator Boyer's press conference on Monday morning saying that, you know, because someone in her family abused her, it severed the relationship with half of the family who didn't believe her, and others who came forward against this perpetrator. She had to tell her mother that she was going to be at the press conference, and maybe there was a lot of television coverage. She had to tell her boss that, you know, I was abused as a child, and I'm supporting Senator Boyer's extension of the statute of limitations. So, John, it's very, very complicated for people to, you know, even when they're brave enough to come up and talk about it. And our concern is that when one person comes forward, then they find out others have been abused by the same person. You know, we saw that in the Olympics with the gymnastic team. We saw that at Penn State. So this is just a horrible thing that happens to these people, and I think the time for the correct action is now. I really admire Senator Boyer.
By the way, Senator Boyer was an aide to the Speaker before he became a member of the House, and then he became a member of the Senate. He's been around long enough to know how to get this done. He's probably going to get his way. Andrea, we're almost out of time here. We got on a little bit late. Very quickly, you're going to work tomorrow and Saturday, and then Monday maybe, right?
Yes, that's what they're telling us, to be prepared for those three times.
Well, that's ridiculous. That's just ridiculous.
I know. And, John, I'm really sad because I had hoped to be at the Sunnyside graduation tonight. I go with Richard Fimbres to the VA hospital to give Memorial Day cards to our awesome veterans, because, see, another VA hospital is in my district, and lots of other things in my district. So, but that's the job. So
it is the job.
I'm up for the challenge, and we'll be here fighting for education, for environmental issues, and for the people of Arizona, and try to kill some of the bad things.
Well, that's why we support you. I hope you have a great weekend, considering.
Thank you.
And thanks for being on the show with us. We appreciate it.
Okay. You're very welcome, John.
State Senator Andrea D'Alessandro. Let me introduce you to Ed Ackerley. He's an independent candidate for mayor. You're in a process of trying to complete the number of signatures needed to get on the ballot, and it I'm sure surprised you as well as anybody else of how many more you had to get than anybody else and how much longer it probably took than you expected.
You're correct. We are going to top over 5,000 pretty soon here.
That's a big deal.
That's a big number. You know, that shows the commitment from my volunteers and from the people that have been helping me get the signatures. And I think that's an important thing, because that does demonstrate that we're serious about the campaign, that we're committed to it, and that the bar that they set for an independent, which is 2,445, will exceed that by double. And now, of course, there is the vetting process, and some of those signatures will be thrown out because the people don't live in Tucson, or they think they do, but they don't live in the city directly, or a number of different reasons. But that rate of throwing out a certain number of signatures is, we've got some insurance there, and I think it's going to be good for us.
It's more than likely going to be three Democrats that'll be vying for the Democratic nomination. I don't know whether the Republican's going to qualify or not. What do you hear? I guess it's up to you to tell me. But
right. I was with him the other day at a forum where a couple of the Democrats, and he was there. And we know he's a fine man, and I've had some discussions with him. And, you know, it's tough for anybody to go out and get signatures. Those that have had to do it, it's one of the tough things we do, but to get us ready for doing the job. It's not easy to collect signatures, and it's a difficult process. So I'm not sure where he is, but I know he had some more to get last time I talked with him.
Tony's a caller to our show. Tony, you're with Ed Ackerley, independent candidate for mayor. Hi, Tony.
Yes, hi, Ed. I don't know if you're a Democrat or Republican. Doesn't matter to me. I got a specific question concerning water meters and the state of our water system here in Tucson. There is a issue in New Mexico concerning the Badger water meters, and they are malfunctioning and reading improperly and charging people extra. As mayor, how would you contend with a situation like that if you find out that the meters they're using here in the city of Tucson are overcharging people?
Well, that has been an issue that has come up before, and certainly in residential areas and even in industrial users. the water metering and making sure that we're counting the right. So one of the issues tends to be, and first off, water is an enterprise zone, and so the city does control that, but it is an enterprise zone, and it operates as an extension of the budget, but outside of that scope. And so one of the things that we need to do is to make sure the technology is there, and obviously there is. Over the last 100 years, the technology has far outstripped what most water meters are, and so. But how do we go about funding, you know, a couple hundred thousand water meters across the city? So we just have to make sure that those water meters are accurate, that they're reading the levels correctly, and if anybody has an anomaly with their bill. So what would I do? Well, that's an ongoing process. They are replacing meters as they can, and certainly if someone sees a dramatic shift in their rate, they need to be in touch with Tucson Water to make sure that is mitigated. But as a mayor and city council, that issue is, again, a part of the enterprise zone, and so that's kind of contained within the water department. And I have had meetings with the water director and talked about water issues. And, you know, as with all technology, whether it be analog or digital or the newest thing, we have to monitor it and make sure that it is counting the water correctly.
Tony, thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate your call. We know that there's a terrible problem with the recycling effort in Tucson. We know that we're going to pick up recyclable items from residential homes every other week rather than every week. We know that there's no market for some of this. Much of what we thought was recyclable has gone into the landfill. I think there's millions of dollars at stake. I'm not so sure the Tucson public has been aware of everything that's going on with this recycling effort. Are the challenges ahead to even make it viable again? What is your take on that? You've talked with the people that run the recycling system for the city of Tucson. Do you have any confidence in it now?
I do. I think they do have a handle on the situation, the problem. I think they were a little slow, perhaps, to react to the commodities of plastics not being purchased. And, you know, that's just, you live and learn on those kinds of things. Who would know that after many years, the bottom would fall out of the plastic recycling and then that would become a problem. But I do think that the director has a good handle on a plan for this, and they have approached the city manager, and obviously the council has approved the idea of picking up every other week to reduce some cost and mitigate those costs. And they have a plan in place. They've pulled some budget from some other areas to help them in the short term, and they've given them a period of time to come up with a plan to mitigate the recyclable problem. So they have a little breathing room in the sense that they're not hemorrhaging money anymore, and they've got a plan in place to reduce the service, but at the same time come up with a plan to help figure out what to do with this stuff when we pick it up from houses, and how do we get it through the system. And you know, it'd be unfortunate if we're picking up from the back of the house and the front of the house and taking all of it to the city dump.
I think we've done that before.
Yeah, that would be a duplication of effort, and obviously against the wishes of what the voters wanted many years ago, which was to try and implement a recycling program. So we've got our work cut out for us in that area, and I think that we've got a plan in place, and I think the director is doing a good job of we'll be presenting a plan to city council and to the manager here shortly.
One of the great costs to the city, and one of its I think most serious responsibilities, is to the traffic of Tucson and the mobility of so many of us that live here and must have a vehicle in order to conduct not only our business lives but our personal lives as well, as Tucson's kind of spread out from Helangan, and it's really difficult if you don't have a car, although many people do depend upon mass transit. With additional monies, what would you do with additional transportation dollars? Expand the SunTran downtown or our buses? Would you add more money to RTA to expand thoroughfares? What is the future of transportation dollars for the very highest and best use of our tax dollars and to meet our needs of the city?
Well, John, there's been so much deferred maintenance on the roads, and even though there was a tax in place that has been helping to resurface the major arterials and the smaller streets, the residential streets have just really not been paid attention to in some decades, and some of those are in need of serious repair. So my number one goal is to continue to roads, to make sure that the roads are paved and that the potholes are repaired. You know, we filled last year about 4,000 potholes. I think we need to double that and fill 8,000 potholes in the coming year. I think we need to really focus on roads as the number one issue. And it is the number one issue that I hear when I'm out talking with people. But I do believe that the complete streets process will be a good thing, to where we take a look at robo-taxis and automated vehicles, automated trucks, and what do we do? How do we get them throughout the city? How do we take care of the bike lanes and the mass transit? And so the complete streets, what that says is that instead of just planning streets that are only for automobiles, and we put in streets that that are for automobiles, that we take a more holistic view and say, in the coming 50 years, maybe automobiles won't be the only thing that we need to be concerned about. So I'm excited about complete streets, because I think it takes a proactive view to the future, and I think that we need to take a look at some of these new technologies that are coming out. The second thing I would say about streets is that we need to upgrade the technology in the close to 600 traffic lights and intersections that we have. They're just not synchronized, and the part of that problem is the engineers have tried to do the best they can with the resources that they have, but we just don't have the right technology to be able to streamline lights so that people don't have to wait. And so that's a process. You just can't take down all the streetlights and put up brand new ones, and you can't retrofit them with technology necessarily. And so, but I do believe that should be a priority over the next few years, is to make sure that, and one issue that I have is these things called HOCs. They're the pedestrian lights that go on mid in between lights. There's a crosswalk, and someone pushes the button and boom, the lights go off and they get to cross. Well, I think that's great, and I think we need to be pedestrian sensitive, but I also feel that technology could help us, that, you know, if there's traffic coming, we shouldn't start them at the green light and get them down a quarter of a mile and then stop them again because someone has pushed a hawk and boom, the red lights go on. There's technology out there that we can mitigate that and have that person wait until there's kind of a path for them to go. And also, this will help with the safety issue of, you know, we've had some pedestrian problems here, and just recently we had another one. And, you know, using technology to our advantage to help us. And the third element of this, I think, is technology with SunTran and SunLink and SunVan. You know, this whole concept of using Uber and Lyft to get people around, some of that technology is available for some of these large buses that are going down the street, some of them empty from time to time. We just have to be smarter at how we use technology to address that so that we maximize the use of public transit, so that it's beneficial to those people that need it, but that it's not wasting time or wasting energy when we could be redirecting it in another way. So those are the three areas that I would look at for transportation.
And Ackerley is my guest. He's a independent candidate for mayor. You're one of the most successful ad agency people in Tucson and have been for decades. You said you wanted to be a marketing director for the city of Tucson to sell our city beyond our city limits. We all know that may be really our future if we're going to help those who are underemployed and those who are unemployed. We've got to bring in new money and new opportunities for people. So what would you do?
Well, there's a good example right here in Tucson. There's a couple of buses that are wrapped with a city from another state that are saying, you know, come to our place to visit and have a good time. I was in Chicago a couple of years ago, and we did have one Visit Tucson billboard. When we stepped out of our hotel, we looked up, and there was a billboard about Tucson. But I just think we need the Economic Initiatives Office. Barbara Coffey is the new director there. She has a great great outlook, I think, on this. We kind of agreed when I was talking with her about how do we market the great things that Tucson has to offer in a more robust and meaningful way. Because we need to do that in two ways. One, we need to do that outbound. We need to tell other states, other companies who are thinking about coming to Tucson, visitors who want to come to Tucson and use the resources of Visit Tucson, to come to Tucson and experience what we have to offer. But, you know, we also need to use economic development, economic initiatives locally to tell each other the great things that are happening in Tucson. And we have not done a very good job, I don't think, as a community, of sharing the good things that are going on here up in Phoenix and up in the state capitol, and certainly in other areas of the country where marketing ourselves as the go-to place for the Southwest. I think that we can do that. I think Tucson's a pretty cool place. You know, it's a cool place to live, and I think we can do a better job of earmarking some dollars. Now that the economy is a little bit better and we have a little bit of extra money, I think we should put it into marketing. One of the first things that people cut when the economy gets weak is they go after marketing dollars and advertising dollars because they're the easiest to cut and the easiest. But, you know, we need to advertise when it is good, and we need to advertise like crazy when there's a downturn, because that's the success of advertising, of being there when people begin to think about, oh, we got some options, and one of those options might be Tucson.
We have an economic development department of the city of Tucson evaluate how efficient and how effective they are, as well as how effective and efficient is TRIO.
I'm excited about the Economic Initiatives Office. Barbara Coffey is the new director, as I said. They're going to move from two people. They've had two people. They're going to move up to five full-time people that are working on these initiatives, and I think that's a good thing. The manager has given them the directive to do a better job of creating opportunities for people. And one of the areas that I talk with her about is you know, I've been in business for 51 years with my brother and our company, and I can't think of a time when anybody's been in my office from the city of Tucson to come and ask me how my business is and how I'm growing. Ironically, I received a note from my scheduler saying that Barbara Coffey wants to come see our agency, and I'm like, I've already talked to her. Am I going back for another meeting with her? And the response from my scheduler, Teresa, was, no, she wants to come to you. She wants to come see your company and see how the city of Tucson can help your company. And I thought, you know, that we need to be doing more of that. We need to be reaching out, because 8 out of 10 jobs that we're going to get in the next decade are going to come from companies that are already here in Tucson. Granted, we're going to bring some new companies in, and we're going to try and incentivize them to come to Tucson, but, you know, 8 out of 10 jobs in the next decade are going to come from companies that are already established in Tucson, and we need to bolster those companies and give them the opportunity to grow.
TRIO.
Well, Sun Corridor, I think they've done a good job in terms of sending the message out. I think they've obviously, their level of company that they're looking for are in the aerospace and then the tourism and the major fields. And so I do think that we need to try, and the Office of Economic Initiatives needs to look at some more things that we can do for medium and smaller sized companies to come to Tucson as well. And part of that is obviously the job that we can do right here in our own backyard at the University of Arizona. I talk about externships with the University of Arizona. What is that? Well, that's getting freshman, sophomore, and junior level students into companies here in Tucson, getting credit and getting some pay for doing some work in Tucson, so that when they develop the new idea in the entrepreneurship college or in the marketing department, or that they think about Tucson when they think about where they're going to establish their business. So this nurture the future here in Tucson, I think, is an important concept for us. And so I think Sun Corridor does a good job of sending the message out globally and nationally to companies. But I also think we need to have a really strong focus on small and medium-sized businesses, and the Economic Initiatives Office can help us in that area.
You're elected mayor. You ought to be up before the Arizona legislature asking for film money. We've really missed the boat on this. I mean, we used to be a film capital of the world. When I first got here in the 60s and 70s, it just fell apart and never came back because we didn't want it back. We didn't try to get it back. A lot of money in film, and this is a place where you can film about 360 days out of the year, and it has a wonderful history of being hospitable to the film industry. Why can't we do that again?
Well, I think we can. I think I'm the only candidate. I am the only candidate that's taught at the University of Arizona and the Film and Television School for the last almost 30 years. My very first assignment at the University of Arizona was in the Film and Television School. In talking with the folks there, you know, what we do need is a new facility out in Marana that is doing commercial production and so forth. But, you know, we had an opportunity a couple of times to get a sound stage that would be able to be used for movie making and also for commercial filmmaking and commercial television commercials. And we just need to, I think, look at that. We need to repurpose some of the buildings that we have downtown or in some of the industrial areas that are vacant. It would be great to have a sound stage. I think the city could be instrumental in that. The Tucson Film Office and the folks there could do a much better job of reaching out. And of course, the state of Arizona, you know, Louisiana and New Mexico and some of the other states that have grown their film industry have given tax incentives to to the filmmakers. And so, you know, if you could save $100,000 up to $1 million in taxes over a year or two when you're filming a major movie, you know, it makes sense. Well, if I'm going to get $1 million in tax incentives, well, let's go to New Mexico, let's go to Santa Fe, let's go to Louisiana, let's go to New Orleans and film there. And Arizona has kind of missed the boat on that in terms of giving some tax incentives. And now that we have $1 billion rainy day fund that the governor has been able to take credit for, I think there's a few dollars there that we could move into the film industry. And, you know, Bob Shelton, God bless him, with the creation of 80 years now, the old Tucson as a film studio, I think we could bring that back and do a much better job helping young people and new people learn. And, you know, the technology has changed so much, we could do a lot more filming in Tucson.
How do people help the Ed Ackerley campaign through this summer?
Well, we are concluding the signature drive this weekend, so we hope to gather another couple hundred signatures, maybe up to 1,000 signatures, and go over the top in a big way. But what I really need is $310 donations. That's the next step in the process for me. I need to get 300 people who live in the city of Tucson to give me a $10 donation, because I'm running as a clean candidate. And that's the bar that they give you to start receiving matching funds. So we're going to make an effort in the month of June. We're going to try and get 10 people a day to give us a $10 check. And that's going to be our focus, our marketing focus for the month of June. And people can go on my website right now, AckerleyForMayor.com, and they can make a $10 donation. And, you know, a $10 donation is a vote of confidence in the ideas that we've brought forth. And it was great today to be with the mayor at the chamber. He was doing a little roundtable with some business leaders. And I was just sitting there kind of, smiling to myself, saying the initiatives that he brought up and the things that he was talking about. At one point he said, you know, municipalities, what are we responsible for? Police and fire, economic development, roads and transportation, parks and recreation. And guess what? That's the tenets of my campaign. That's exactly what I'm here for, leading and administering that. So if people are interested in those kinds of things, I hope they would go on our website and give us a $10 donation.
Ed Ackerley, thanks for being with us. We really, truly appreciate it. Like I say, I ask people to take your campaign seriously because you take it seriously. This is going to be an amazing summer and fall, and an independent candidate for mayor's in the race, in my opinion. We'll be back with Don Jorgensen, former chair of the Democratic Party, after these messages. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the John C. Scott Political Forum. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi claimed today that President Trump wants to be impeached and is upset that the House Democrats are not rushing in that direction now, as tensions continue to mount between the White House and her party. White House is just crying out for impeachment. That's why he flipped yesterday, referring to Trump's abrupt exit from the White House meeting with Democratic leaders on the nation's infrastructure. We called it a kabuki dance. What does it mean? Let's talk with one of the brightest and most keen observers of Democratic politics in America. Here's Don Jorgensen, former chair of the Democratic Party in Pima County. What's going on here, Don?
Well, you have a president who is used to operating as a businessman and not a politician. And he's done away with that for a while, just on the basis of his 2016 win. But we're so far past that, and he's built up such a questionable record in any kind of negotiation that he's lost that credibility as what he used to call the best negotiator around, and as he called himself again today, an extremely stable genius. And so you have a person who has one mode of operating and negotiating, and that's by bullying. And when that fails, as it does with someone who's as experienced and crafty and been dealing with political negotiations for decades, and Nancy Pelosi, he just winds up failing and returning to the kind of the worst aspects of his own behavior and personality, and that's to throw these temper tantrums and to walk out of negotiations and then attack and engage in name calling of the other individuals, which serves not only doesn't serve him well, it doesn't serve the Republican Party, and that's why we're even hearing from leaders in the Republican Party asking him to cool it. But Nancy Pelosi is in his head. Unfortunately, he's not listening to any of these advisors. And once again, not only is anything getting done, he's making many of these situations worse.
You know, she got into a squabble with Kellyanne, obviously the aide to the President of the United States, Kellyanne Conway. But Pelosi refused to fight with her and just ignored her, and that all went away. I mean, Pelosi just seems to be so capable under these circumstances that anybody that doubted her ability to handle this job was sorely mistaken. Sorely mistaken.
You know, it would appear that she really learned a lot of lessons from her first stint as Speaker of the House, where she wasn't nearly as forceful and direct and clear and calculating as she is now. And I use that in a positive term. It seemed like during her first term, she was too focused on kind of the beltway insider political approach, which most folks that don't follow politics every day don't understand. They don't, no one wants to take that much time to really understand what's happening in the day-to-day give and take within Washington. And so that didn't translate well. Well, it seems that she's learned from that, and now her statements seem to be, and her positions, geared toward educating the public and educating folks across America about what's happening and kind of speaking a lot more directly, a lot more plainly and directly than she did in the past. And so you have a marked contrast rather than the political speak of the past Pelosi versus Trump, in which she didn't show well. Now you have kind of the plain speaking Nancy, who's coming from an intelligent standpoint, and mixing that with a clear understanding of the politics involved with Donald Trump, who just comes across as a petulant businessman who's not getting his way and as such storms out of meetings, you know, and we're seeing that pattern with him. You know, when he's engaged in any kind of negotiation, he views it as a transactional event that time. And so we saw him walk out on the meeting with North Korea, and so we have no change there. We saw him essentially walk out more than once on the discussions with China and the trade deals there. And so we have a situation that's worsening. And now we have seen him on more than one occasion walk away from congressional leaders, bipartisan leaders, as well as in this case the Democrats, when there was the possibility of getting things done. They were there to discuss an infrastructure bill that had bipartisan support, and he's walked away and, again, I think, cut off his nose, as my father used to say, cut off his nose to spite his face, and, again, nothing's getting done, and he's looking like the fool in this transaction once again.
By the way, the White House counselor Kellyanne Conway claims that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is not pro-woman, because Pelosi declined to speak with Conway about negotiations with the White House. And Pelosi's response was, "I speak to the president, not to the staff." And so got her again, one more time. It's amazing. It really is.
Which is a lesson in how I think all of the media ought to deal with Kellyanne Conway as well.
I agree. President Trump ratcheted up his feud with the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, turning that event organized to announce a multi-billion-dollar aid package to farmers into a nearly half-hour long-distance diatribe against his Democratic rivals, rejecting Pelosi's characterization of his decision to scrap a meeting Wednesday with the Democrats because of their continued investigation as a temper tantrum. Trump accused Democratic officials of being bad people. Bad people. Referring to Pelosi as Crazy Nancy and enlisting several White House officials to publicly collaborate his account that he addressed the Democrats calmly and not in anger the previous day, which is all a lie. It's amazing. Just another Trump lie.
It is. And you mentioned the intent of that meeting was to talk about the approval of a $19 billion aid package. Actually, there's two packages. That one was, again, another bailout for the farmers. And again, this is taxpayer money going to subsidize farmers hurt by the trade war with China. So because of Trump's failure there, he's touting, taking credit for giving away more taxpayer money to, again, solve a problem he created. So it's this ongoing cycle of continued failure and loss that he somehow tries to twist into success when it's just the opposite.
You know, it's amazing, and you interview farmers, which the networks do all the time, They don't want this subsidy. They want their trade money. They want to trade with China and trade with the world, sell their products and make money. I mean, and they're somewhat embarrassed about this, of taking handout money for not doing anything. It's like, you know, being paid not to plant wheat or corn or whatever, you know, and you'd get paid for doing nothing. And that seems to strike at the heart of really the great character of American farmers. Don?
It's really true. You're right. These are folks that, as like most Americans, want to earn their living and want to succeed by doing the work that they love to do. And they're being prevented from doing that, from dealing with some of them, their major source of customers and revenue, working with selling to China. In addition, we're starting to see now the impact on the public and on all of us. You saw that there were meetings with leaders from Walmart, leaders from Home Depot, who are recognizing that very quickly their prices are going to have to go up and their access to some of the goods that they want to sell is going to be restricted also because of these tariffs. So pretty soon that outcry is going to become larger, because although you can give temporary bailouts to farmers, you can't start giving temporary bailouts to Walmart and Home Depot and John Deere and the auto companies, nor can you give it to the American public who will be going without staples, not just luxury items, but we're talking about appliances, we're talking about needed activities to live their items to live their daily lives. So it's going to very soon have a real effect on all of us. And right now we see no plan on the part of Donald Trump or the White House to get back to the negotiating table.
We're talking with Don Jorgensen, former chair of the Democratic Party. It seems to me that we're going to be at an impasse, almost a stalemate here through the summer. I don't see anything happening at all between the president and the administration. And certainly he's pulling away from what he had offered, which was the beginning, I guess, of talks for a bipartisan support for infrastructure. That's not happening. There is also talk that there really wasn't any money for infrastructure, no matter what he was saying. You know, I mean, there wasn't the money that even could have started the infrastructure that both sides were talking about, so he just pulled out of it. Don't you believe that we're not going anywhere for a while?
No, and in fact, anything you read, when you bring up infrastructure in the Trump administration, it seems to be a punchline that I can't recall, and I'm not sure you could either, how many infrastructure weeks we have had since the start of the Trump administration. I think at least half a dozen, and we have nothing. And again, this is one of those other comments that Nancy Pelosi made that I think got under Donald Trump's skin, is that she made clear that they also believe he walked out of that meeting in part because he has no plan. And he's unwilling to accept the plan from the Democrats in the House. And it was explained even from their discussions about their infrastructure plan, which is pretty comprehensive, that there's room for negotiation. That's what Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic leaders understand whenever you're going to pass legislation, that it's going to take that. They were open to that. And the Republicans in the Senate, from what we've read, were also open to it. And it looked like something that could have gotten done. And again, now it is just going to languish. There is another bill just like that sitting out there right now, and that's a bipartisan agreement. And we're talking about bipartisan agreement in the Senate on a $19 billion aid package dealing with all the areas that have been hit by disasters in the U.S. over the past year, based on floods and hurricanes and such. And it includes not only additional funds for Puerto Rico, but directing the administration to release funds that had already been approved for Puerto Rico, I think about $9 billion. And so this is an aid package, again, that is ready for approval by the Senate. Once that happens, the House has already said there won't be any problem approving it, and it'll be presented to the president to sign. So here's one definite area and another clear area with regard to infrastructure where the Democrats are saying we're fine with the president signing these and even taking credit for getting something done. And he has managed to screw that up. And as you say, it may well languish through the summer before anything's done.
Well, you take a look at this, and it just seems to be almost an endless battle of just words and no action. We've got a tension building between Iran and the United States that's very dangerous. There's no question about that. Watching North Korea continue to do whatever they want to do, despite all the talks that have taken place over the last year, is still a frightening situation to most foreign affairs observers, that they feel like North Korea has the upper hand and has continued to have the upper hand over Donald Trump. Then you take a look at the tariffs and our battle with China and what's happening with our money in Europe, and you realize it's just one thing after another, and you can't forget immigration reform, because there are literally thousands, if not tens of thousands, of people coming to America, whether we like it or not, and we have no particular plan to try to halt this immigration crunch, nor any plan whatsoever to continue with a conversation about immigration reform, which is absolutely critical to this country. We're not getting anything done. And that'd be the first thing that John McCain would say, and the last thing I would say. We're just not getting anything done.
That's right. We're seen to be on a theme this afternoon. Again, recall that Donald Trump walked away from a bipartisan immigration agreement last year when party representatives from both parties were in his office and the Oval Office had agreed on an immigration reform package that included DACA. And he had his head turned by some of his advisors, like Stephen Moore from the far right, walked away from that. Immigration reform could have been done and in place. And instead, as you say, we have an increasing crisis, not just on the border, but throughout the U.S., where we now find that over 5,000 families are still separated. We're still learning about, a sixth migrant child who died while in Border Patrol or custody of Homeland Security. It's just outrageous. And then your second comment, dealing with Iran, I would ask anyone, and I'm not sure that you could get a coherent answer, to describe what this administration's foreign policy is and what specific plan they have to deal with Iran, because we aren't hearing anything, and what we're hearing is very difficult to believe whenever any message comes out of the White House. I followed closely what our representative from the Phoenix area, Ruben Gallego, has said, because he has sat in on these intelligence briefings and had mentioned, and this is very disturbing, that much of the intelligence being presented to Congress from the administration is manipulated and exaggerated.
That's really frightening to hear. Listen, I'm up against the clock here, headed for a news break in about 30 seconds. Don, I really appreciate you being on our show today. Thank you so much for your observations. We'll talk soon, but again, thank you very much. Have a great holiday weekend. I really thank you.
You too, John. My pleasure.
Thank you. Pamela Powers-Hanley was our guest, a member of the State House of Representatives. Dr. Jalen Hellick, our progressive voice from California. Thomas L. Tan, a medical marijuana spokesman, was with us. Andrew D'Alessandro, state senator. Ed Ackerley, independent candidate for mayor. And Don Jorgensen, former chair of the Democratic Party. Have a great evening, everybody. Sports is next with Steve Rivera, one of the best talk shows on sports anywhere in America. You're going to love Steve Rivera. He's up next. We'll take a break and be back on Tuesday to talk with you. Hope you have a great holiday weekend. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great evening.